Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. Pramila Jayapal has been a member of Congress for less than 3 years, but the Congresswoman has already helped to shift the conversation in Washington, D.C. As the co-chair of the House Progressive Caucus, the civil rights activist turned politician has helped elevate Medicare for All and the Green New Deal. She's also pushed to overhaul the country's broken immigration system. Crosscut political reporter Melissa Santos talked to the Congresswoman about what it means to be a powerful progressive in the Trump era and a woman of color in this new Congress. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and BECU. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Hey, everybody. Well, thank you all for being here today, and thank you, Congresswoman, for joining me. We have a lot to talk about from this week in Congress. I covered the state legislature, was busy with that, and then looked up, and suddenly there was a Barr hearing, and Mueller report this, and Medicare for All, and Congresswoman Jayapal is at the center of all of that. So we're going to get to that. But first, I do want to talk a little bit about how we have this Congresswoman with us today and her background. So you were elected in 2016, and you served in the state Senate before that, and we met in that capacity, I think, first. But before that, Congresswoman Jayapal founded and served as the executive director of One America, which is a civil rights and group in immigration advocacy. So she was a real leader on that. So now that's been 3 years, you're going your third year in Congress, and you've become a leader in this progressive caucus that we have, the House Progressive Caucus. And also we've seen you mentoring some of the younger progressives in the House as well. So I want to ask you about something you told Vox recently. You said that the progressive caucus hasn't leveraged its power strategically before. What did you mean by that, and how are you trying to change that now?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here, everybody. The Progressive Caucus has, before it was sort of like it was a social group. You know, it was established actually originally by Bernie Sanders, Maxine Waters, a long time ago. When Keith Ellison came in as the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, he started to really think about what does it mean to have members? How do we make sure we vote together? How do we make sure we use our power to move issues forward? And then when Mark Pocan and I took over as co-chairs, we started really thinking seriously about that. That was actually last year before this election. And we worked very hard to come up with ways that if we were to be lucky enough to take back the House, which we did, if we were lucky enough to be able to increase the numbers of the Progressive Caucus, which we did, we are now 40% of the Democratic Caucus, that we would be able to hold our people together around key issues that we care about. And so we've done that in a number of ways at the beginning of the session before giving our support to Speaker Pelosi as the speaker during her race. We said we wanted equal representation of progressives on what we call the money committee. So Ways and Means, Appropriations, Financial Services. That's the first time progressives have ever had that. So we were able to do that. We were able to negotiate for a Medicare for All hearing, first ever in the history of Congress. And then most recently, we'll get to talk about that, so you'll really get to cheer when we get to that. And then most recently, on the budget fight, we really didn't appreciate $733 billion defense spending being proposed, and then $100 billion less for domestic spending. So we were able to use our power to just say that we weren't going to be able to vote for that. We, of course, negotiated. And so that's the kind of work that you'll continue to see us do.
Did that and got that negotiated before agreeing to support Nancy Pelosi for speaker, right? Was that part
of
how that worked out?
The original 40, yeah, we had three major asks. One was 40% representation on the key committees. Another was I'm trying to think of what the other one was now. I've just gone blank. It's only been, what did somebody say what it was? And then the third one was the Medicare for All hearing. Yeah.
So let's talk about that, because that hearing just happened last week, this week, I guess.
Oh, I remembered the second one. Oh,
okay.
Sorry. It was leadership positions for progressives. So the leadership team used to be very, very small. And what we were able to do is expand the number of positions within the leadership team. And then we ran progressives for those positions. So we got Catherine Clark in as caucus vice chair, Hakeem Jeffries as caucus chair. Barbara Lee was also running. I was supporting Barbara, but either one of them are progressives. And then a number of others within the Democratic Policy and Communications Committee.
So, and you got the speaker to agree to hold a hearing on Medicare for All. We just had that. And, I mean, this is your plan, which is different from Bernie Sanders' plan. You have your own plan here that's talking about moving the nation to a single government insurer in a two-year time frame. How did the hearing go this week? What was your big takeaway from that?
It was fantastic. And for anybody that didn't have a chance to watch it, I would really recommend that you watch, at least watch the beginning testimony from Adi Barkin. If you can watch the whole hearing, it was a detailed, real debate about our healthcare system and the need to transition it to a single-payer system. Adi was phenomenal. For those people who don't know him, he's an activist. He was diagnosed a couple of years ago with ALS, terminal ALS. So he has very little time left to live. And he speaks through, he has lost his voice because of the disease. So he speaks through a computerized machine. And he made it so that people understand this is about life and death, and that healthcare in this country is a crisis, and that, frankly, it is a disgrace that the richest, most industrialized country in the world cannot provide healthcare to all of our individuals in the country.
So certainly that moral question was on display at the hearing as well, and I know that you and other progressives have talked about how, you know, everyone's focused on how to pay for this and talking about that as a criticism in a way, but that should be the first question, right, in your mind?
Correct.
Okay. Well, I do want to ask a little bit, because one thing I think did come up, even some other Democrats have questioned the timeline. I think Bernie Sanders' plan talks about 4 years for implementation. Yep. Yours talks about two. I think Donna Shalala, who was a Health and Human Services Secretary under the Clinton administration, said 2 years she's not sure is feasible. What's your response to that sort of pushback or criticism?
I think this is what hearings are for, to debate, you know, pieces of a bill. If we got to a place where somebody said, listen, I think it should be four, but we'll do your plan, I would be the first to say, great, let's do it. But I think the reason we made it two, and I'm very grateful to Bernie, we worked very closely with his plan, looked at the best of his plan, looked at the best of what had been proposed in the past, and then worked with a huge coalition of organizations, including disability rights folks. So for the first time, my bill has long-term care supports and services. So we address the needs of our seniors and folks with disabilities. Bernie included a component of that into his new bill. So we're working together and off of each other. But listen, the reason I put 2 years in was because there were a lot of economists who looked at Bernie's plan and the four-year transition and said the problem with a longer, obviously the benefits are clear of a longer transition. It's gradual, you can kind of do things a little bit at a time. But the problem with a longer transition is you have to keep existing systems in place for longer, knowing that they are then going to have to be phased out, which means that healthcare premiums, insurance premiums for those for-profit insurers will go way up because they'll know they're not going to be in the marketplace anymore. So a lot of economists said to us, shorten the transition time, make it 2 years, and remember that Medicare was established in 1 year. And there were no computers back then, but it was all done within a year. Now we have two-thirds of the system is already on, is already in the computer, if you will, in some way, right? Because we have Medicaid, Medicare, and then we have employer health coverage. So all of those systems need to be combined. That's year one in my plan. And then year two is let's just make sure it's all working well. So it's 62 and above and 19 and under. And then year three is everybody. And we think that's a really good transition. But, you know, all of these things are details that can be worked out over time.
I love how I was going to ask you a question to explain your plan, and we think we just did that. So I do want to, you know, the thing that always comes up.
Can I say something about just the plan? Because I do think this is really important. The main thing is everybody is covered. And everybody is covered with comprehensive care. So you will get mental health, dental, vision, reproductive care. We get rid of the Hyde Amendment in this plan so that women can actually have access to reproductive care. So you really will have everything that you need, comprehensive care, and you will not have to deal with 8 different insurers. And by the way, everyone will be in-network. There won't be an in-network out-of-network. So you use the same system of doctors and hospitals that exists today, but the only difference is that the government provides the insurance. So that's the only person you have to deal with, and it's an expansion of the current Medicare system. We expand the benefits that are provided under Medicare, and then we also expand who it goes to, so it goes to everybody.
So I'm going to be the person who asks about paying for it. I mean, I do think that, you know, for instance, I want to talk about Vermont. Vermont is a state that had a lot of support to do a Medicare for All or a universal single payer healthcare plan. Yeah. Past that part of it, you know, the vision that you're talking about for coverage. But then when they later came to the point of, hey, how are we going to pay for this? There was talk of the 11.5% payroll tax and then an income tax to increase of 9% or so, and support just completely fell apart. How do you prevent that complete collapse happening with your plan?
Well, Vermont is really interesting. I actually just came from doing the keynote at the Vermont Democratic Party, so I got...
Vermont more than me, so...
Yeah, I got deeply engrossed into what happened there. And what's really interesting is that piece of legislation... they were not allowed to implement it. And in fact, the legislation said it couldn't be implemented for 4 years because it passed at the same time that the Affordable Care Act passed. And they had to set up their exchanges before they could get the plan that they had passed through. And most voters didn't know that. So they voted for the thing. They thought it was going to happen immediately. And then nothing was happening. And the Affordable Care Act was sort of being put into place, number one. Number two, so it actually never got off the ground. Number two, I do think you have to deal with this at a federal level. I mean, you really can't. States can do certain things, but you need the federal streams of money from the federal government in order to be able to make the whole thing work. So the same thing happened in Colorado, and Ed Perlmutter actually talked about it at the hearing. He said he didn't vote for that because it was a state. Going to the cost, anybody know? This is such a smart district and such a smart crowd, but do you know how much it costs currently the healthcare system in our country? Should I just tell you? $3.2 trillion a year is what we're spending today. That would be $32 trillion over 10 years if those costs stayed the same. But in fact, all the research shows that that number is increasing dramatically. We will go up to $5.5 trillion within 10 years. So that's $55 trillion over 10 years. Even the most conservative studies from the Koch brothers say that the Medicare for All plan would save money for the economy and would cost $32 trillion. So let me ask you, if you could pay $32 trillion and get everything covered and just one insurance plan versus $50 trillion with nothing covered, which one would you choose?
Absolutely correct. I don't dispute that the costs in the overall healthcare system, you know, would not necessarily even be surpassed. You would certainly save perhaps overall, and there's been analysis that have said that with any Medicare for All plan. But there still involves a transfer sort of to the federal budget of some of those private costs. And how do you navigate that discussion?
Well, I mean, the thing I would say is that 2/3 of the cost of the plan is already being paid for. The federal government is already paying for Medicare, Medicaid, and public subsidies. So what you're really left with is about 1/3 the people who are on employer healthcare or not covered. And the employer healthcare system is costing more and more for individuals. So the average family who has insurance is paying between $10,000 and $18,000 a year in out-of-pocket premiums, deductibles, and copays. So the reality is that people are already paying for the costs of this system. And what would happen if we instituted a universal healthcare system is there are a lot of businesses who are thrilled about this, by the way. They would be happy to pay a tax on, somebody just raised his hand, a tax on for their employees to the government if they wouldn't have to deal with getting healthcare for everybody. So we believe that we could actually bring down the cost for employers slightly, and that the average family would pay 14% less with our Medicare for All plan, because you wouldn't be paying for your copays, premiums, and deductibles, and you wouldn't be going to GoFundMe as your number one insurance program. That is just insane.
Are you finding that your biggest barrier right now is the current administration when it comes to implementing Medicare for All, or is it also some of the more moderate Democrats who aren't or aren't convinced yet?
We have work to do because we have forgotten in this country that to be bold is who we are as a country. We have forgotten that we cannot continue to focus on incremental change when we have inequality of such massive scale, when we have healthcare crisis of such massive scale. So, you know, I'm an organizer, and I believe we have to build the movement. We got our first ever Medicare for All hearing this week in the House of Representatives, first time in the history of our country. And right after that, Richie Neal gave me a commitment that he would do a hearing in Ways and Means, which is the committee with the biggest jurisdiction, so we'll move on to Ways and Means. And then if you watched Audie Barkin's tweet the other day, he said, my wish is this, because Nancy Pelosi said to him as she welcomed him to the hearing, she said, your wish is my command, Audie. And he tweeted and he said, my wish is that we get a vote on Medicare for All, and I will come and whip 218 votes for you. That is an organizing project, both within Congress to get more members on board, but also outside for people to really work to have people understand exactly what we're talking about and how critical it is. One more thing about what's in the plan, prescription drug pricing. So incredibly important. So what I have done is I have included in the bill Lloyd Doggett's excellent bill that not only allows for negotiation of prescription drug prices the same way we do for the VA, but it actually not only has that carrot, but it also has a stick of compulsory licensing. So if a pharmaceutical manufacturer refuses to negotiate with the government for a brand name drug, then we will say fine, but then we will allow for compulsory licensing of a generic. You cannot keep a good drug away from the people who need it the most, particularly when it's funded by taxpayer dollars.
I want to shift gears for a minute and ask you about your experience as a woman and a woman of color in the House of Representatives. So I think it was in 2017, we all saw a representative called you, quote, young lady on the House floor. And not only a young lady, but one who, quote, doesn't know a damn thing she's talking about. And I believe you were 51 years old, perhaps, at that time. How often do these type of incidents happen? And given that we don't have that many women of color in Congress, we have about 25% women now, but that's not 50%.
Right.
And what advice can you give to others, and are you giving to some of the other women who are entering this arena?
Yeah. 11,000 plus people that have ever served in the history of Congress, only 67 women of color ever in the history of Congress. Thank you, 7th District, for electing one of those. And yes, it happened a lot in my first term in particular. It happens less this time because I think people have realized, oh, wait a second, we better not mess with her, which is good. But yes, I was told by Don Young, called a young lady. I shut down the floor, demanded that he take down his words, and demanded a public apology, which I got. In fact, at the very end of that particular incident, the floor leader, the floor leader came over to me and said, oh, well, you know, we can strike his words from the record. Will that be okay with you, Representative? I said, no, I want a public apology. And he looked at me and he said, well, I don't think you understand. That's Don Young. And I said, well, I don't think you understand. I'm Pramila Jayapal.
Well, you've now become sort of a mentor. You've been there 3 years, but there are young people coming into Congress who, or younger representatives who are looking toward you. I don't want to call them young ladies. I'm not trying to do that. But, you know, that includes Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. And, we've seen reports that you invite folks over to your wherever you're staying in Capitol Hill, your apartment, and cook for them. What kind of advice are you giving them to navigate some of these progressive and also sort of treacherous waters in Congress here?
Well, they're amazing women and men. I have some men that I work with as well, mentoring and kind of talking about how to do things. And they're amazing. They're really talented, really smart. They bring so much. But sometimes you just need to be able to talk through what is happening. And particularly for women of color, I think they come in and like me, they face all these things. You know, diversity is nice to have, but it isn't just checking the box. It means you're going to get different viewpoints at the table, and people are going to raise things that perhaps have not been raised before. And so a lot of the conversation we have is talking through how to deal with something, how to navigate something. Sometimes I say to people, I know that is driving you crazy, but you have to think about you know, if you try to take every single element of racism and sexism and discrimination on, you will be exhausted. And we need you for the really big battles. So think about which sword you want to fall on. But a lot of times it really is solidarity. I mean, it is a tough environment. And I came in new. It's just been a couple of years. And so that is helpful to them as well. I spent a lot of time before they got in, first trying to help elect them. I was the first member of Congress to endorse both Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, and worked very closely with Deb Haaland. I think I was the first member to endorse Deb Haaland. I was early for Sharice David. I mean, I really have made it a part of my campaign and my work to try to help get other women of color in particular elected. So it's really it's a solidarity, it's a group of women in particular who feel like we can trust each other, we can talk to each other. I know one member, I won't say who, was really having trouble with a vote and called me and said, I don't know what to do, you know, how should I deal with this? I know my heart wants to do this, but I'm worried about what people in my district will say. And I said, I think you should sit with yourself for 5 minutes and think about what you really feel is the right thing to do. And both of those things have reasons that they're right. But you have to, you're representing the district. So think about where you want to fall on this. And she did, and she thanked me later for it. Because, you know, I think there's so much happening. And there's a lot of pressure to vote in a particular way or to do a particular thing. And you can forget who you are. And for me, being elected office is thinking about what I want to do, not who I want to be. I don't really, the Congresswoman title is great because of the power it gives me to get the things I get done. But other than that. It's just a title, so.
So now that we are seeing more women, people of color elected to Congress, what either are we seeing or can we expect to see in terms of maybe changes to policy? You talked about the big battles. What are those and how will this affect that as opposed to having it, well, still predominantly white and male, but, you know, how is it changing and what tangibly might the effects be of that?
Well, I think you see a lot on, you know, institutionalized racism, immigration. I think even though the policy change hasn't come yet, the more folks we get that are willing to challenge what is seen as okay. I mean, is it okay to keep talking about border security when the border is more secure than it's ever been in the history of our country? How do we frame these discussions differently? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's work on the Green New Deal with the Sunrise Movement has been fantastic. It's really lifted that to a whole different level. And I think on Medicare for All, you know, you see these women coming in, and Johanna Hayes is an example, from Connecticut, a lot of insurance companies in Connecticut. Johanna, African-American woman, won the Teacher of the Year award under the Obama administration, really fantastic. And she said to me, you know what, I am getting on the Medicare for All bill, even though I'm in a swing district, because it is the right thing to do. And I am here to do everything I can for as long as I can. But if I get voted out because I do the right thing, that is okay with me. That's a very different way of thinking about your time in Congress than a lot of people come in with.
I do want to talk to you about immigration. I know you're working on a lot of other issues, but that's sort of where you started in activism. And so we have not seen comprehensive immigration reform. We have seen various things at the border. We've seen the travel ban. We've seen all these things. For you, what needs to come next when it comes to fixing the broken immigration system? And what must comprehensive immigration reform look like to you to be successful?
Well, comprehensive immigration reform is completely reframing what immigration is to this country and why it's important, given the context of what the president is doing. But for us, it's been the same thing for a long time. We have to make sure that we get the 11 million undocumented immigrants out of the shadows with a path to citizenship and legalization. We need to make sure that we're fixing all of the broken ways in which our system operates. That's how do families get reunited, right? If you are here and you're a U.S. citizen and you meet somebody who is not a U.S. citizen and you marry them, they should be able to stay here with you. Same thing with your kids. If you're going to bring people in to do work in the fields, in the farms, or in the service sector, then we should be able to have those people have the rights that they should have on the job, move their visas from one job to another. And yes, if they want to stay, we should have a process where they can stay. So those are all the pieces of comprehensive immigration reform. We actually know what the policy solutions are. We've known what they are for a long time. It's just the political will. And unfortunately, in this administration, he is not going to fix anything on immigration because it is too valuable for him, in his view, as a political tool to try to rev up a 30% of his base that really wants to otherize immigrants. And so I'm sad to say that. I have always been an optimist. I've always believed that both sides agree on this issue, and I still believe that. But this president is cruel, unkind, heartless, and immoral on many of the questions that relate to immigration.
So I want to ask you about the political will, because, I mean, then we get to 2020. Clearly, there's a huge effort to potentially try and win a few seats in the Senate. That seems a little bit more tougher. But even if you did win as Democrats, both chambers of Congress and won back the presidency, we didn't see action on immigration reform in 2010 when, I believe, 2009. We didn't see that when Obama's first term. As Democrats, everyone had every chamber, the Democrats did. So what, I don't say, when I said we, I'm not a Democrat, I'm nonpartisan. However, so my point is, what can we expect to be different in 2020, even if everything goes to the Democratic plan and the presidency and both chambers of Congress go to the Democrats?
Well, it's such an excellent point. And some of you know that in my history of immigration work, I criticized Democrats. In fact, there was a cover story in the New York Times Magazine on me and the work that I've done on immigration. And I said that we have been weak on this issue. Democrats should have fixed it, we could have fixed it, and we should have fixed it. But I feel like finally we are coming to a place where Trump, in a weird sort of way, has united us around the need for immigrants. I mean, when I started working on Hate-Free Zone after 9/11, I couldn't get very many elected officials to come to a mosque with me and stand up for Muslims. Today, every Democrat is supporting repealing the Muslim ban. Every Democrat is going to be on the Dream TPS bill that we pass off the House floor. Every Democrat is against family separation. So I think we have come a long way, in part because of the movements and the organizing on the ground, but we have got to get this done. It undercuts so much else, and if we don't address it, it will continue to leave it out. Last point on this, Trumpism did not come from nowhere. Economic inequality in this country has grown to 1920s level. Three people in the United States, two of whom live in our state, have as much wealth as 160 million Americans. 50% of our country has the same wealth as three individuals. That gaping economic inequality leaves a lot of space. It leaves a void, a chasm for racism, white supremacy, otherizing, vilifying, all of that to come out and flourish. And that's where Trumpism came from. So even if we get Trump out of the White House, we have got to deal with institutionalized racism and with economic inequality in this country, or that will just persist. And so I'm 150% committed to reversing our tax system, to really giving opportunity to everybody and making sure, and healthcare is a part of that, education is a part of that, making sure that people feel like there is real opportunity for them and that you don't have to be in the 1% in order to get wealth in this country, much less opportunity.
I am gonna move on to the Mueller report, because that also, this was a very jam-packed week in Congress, and we had a hearing in which William Barr, the Attorney General, did not show up. And we had a little bit of background with that. We did hear Robert Mueller, the special counsel who completed the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, said that the Attorney General did not summarize his remarks and his conclusions and his entire report properly. So, a couple things. One, what are you trying to see happen with the Mueller report now that it is out? There's not a full version, but there's a redacted version that is available to you. And what's next just on that front right now?
Well, we have to see the full report, the unredacted report. And we also have to see all the underlying material that went along with his conclusions. And we issued a subpoena, which was due, the materials were due to us on Wednesday of this week, so just a couple days ago. And Bill Barr blew through the subpoena. He ignored the subpoena. And on Wednesday night, we got a letter, Chairman Nadler got a letter, and the Judiciary Committee got a letter from the Attorney General saying that he did not think that we had a legitimate right to that information. Congress is at least a co-equal branch of government. We are actually Article I, so you could argue that we're first, okay? But we are at least a co-equal branch of government. And when the Attorney General refuses to comply with a congressionally authorized subpoena, we are in dark, dark days. So Chairman Nadler has given him until Monday to give us the materials. We are trying one more time. And if that does not work, then we will issue a contempt citation and we will explore both the legal remedies, which is through the courts, but also there is something called inherent authority that we have around citations. You know, there used to be a congressional jail where you could go and put somebody into jail. There are fines, but you can actually legitimately use inherent authority to jail somebody. This is outrageous behavior from the Attorney General, from the President. The very next day, he decided not to come and testify before us, and it is absolutely outrageous. Combine that with the President saying he is not going to comply with a single subpoena that the House issues. He is not going to allow witnesses like Don McGahn to come and testify before us. He is actively continuing to obstruct justice, and everybody should understand that the difference between a dictatorship and a democracy is that in a dictatorship, one branch makes, one person makes all the decisions. In a democracy, you have co-equal branches of government. So if in a democracy, one branch of government says we are not going to give any authority to a co-equal branch of government, we certainly are shifting towards dictatorship, and it is something that keeps me awake at night and should keep every American awake at night in terms of where we are in this country and the freedoms and the democracy and the constitutional foundations of who we are as a country.
So I want to talk to you about what you do with what you have from the report now. I know you're trying to get more information, but you know, early on, before the report came out, the redacted report, Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, talked about maybe about impeachment being maybe unwise unless it was extremely bipartisan with compelling evidence. The report that, as we, at least what we've seen of it at this point, did not return charges or did not necessarily, on a surface level, provide that. And so what I'm wondering is, what is your view on the Mueller report? Do you completely disagree with my characterization right there? And do you think its contents that you've seen warrant impeachment proceedings at this point?
I do disagree with how you've characterized it, but it's consistent with what Trump and the Attorney General want people to think. I read the 400-page report in detail. It's all marked up and everything. And it is damning. I mean, the first volume, which gets very little attention, is all about Russian interference into our election. You know that Donald Trump just had an hour-long conversation with Vladimir Putin and never raised what is a clear conclusion in the first volume that Russia interfered in terrible, terrible ways. And I really hope everyone reads the report. The second volume lays out 10 charges of obstruction of justice. And in throughout the report, Mueller makes it clear that there was compelling evidence around the issues of conspiracy and coordination in the first volume. There just wasn't, in his view, enough evidence that perhaps you could call them crimes, right? And even then, what he says in there is he paid a lot of attention to the OLC ruling that you can't, or OLC opinion that you can't indict a sitting president. That was a big part of the reason he didn't put forward any charges, because he went along with that. But what he did is he also, in the second volume, obstruction of justice, 10 charges of obstruction of justice that he lays out essentially for Congress to take up. That is a substantial wrongdoing. And so is there a smoking gun? To me, some of the smoking gun is the notes. You know, for Nixon and Watergate, it was the tapes. Here, the notes from Don McGahn's assistant who was in the room, or counsel who was in the room, who took actual notes on everything. In the report, Mueller says and then Barr lied about this, that there is substantial evidence that the president told Don McGahn to lie, and that Don McGahn did not lie because he did not feel that was appropriate. But the president told him to lie. The president, he goes on to document a number of instances in which the president clearly lied, Bill Barr clearly lied, and I think this is, it's crazy to me that we would say, well, if there isn't enough evidence to charge the person for a crime, that that somehow clears him. In fact, he didn't say there was no evidence, he said substantial evidence. Almost everything that Bill Barr said in his four-page report, which was not a summary at all, total mischaracterization, according to Robert Mueller himself, but also in the news conference that he had later when he released the redacted report, as well as in the Senate when he testified, he lied over and over again. Bill Barr, by the way, should resign. He should not be attorney general.
So do you think that there's enough evidence that so far all of those charges that didn't result in charges but are, as you say, substantial evidence, do you think impeachment is something the House should initiate?
Well, I think for sure he has conducted behavior that is impeachable. He has conducted behavior that amounts to high crimes and misdemeanors. What we wanted to do was to really get as much information as we could, and we still need to do that, to see the scope of what has happened. And that is what the Mueller report would have provided, but not just the Mueller report, because Judiciary Committee has, the Mueller report was actually fairly narrow in scope. Judiciary Committee has authorization and jurisdiction over public corruption and the Emoluments Clause, over abuse of power and obstruction of justice. So we have a whole range of things that we need to be looking at. And our goal was to try to get all of that information and have a series of hearings where we could find out the information and where we could lay it out for the American people. Because unfortunately, too many people across the country don't know what to think about this and they don't know what to believe because there's so much fake news coming at them. And so if we are not allowed to do that because the president blocks everything, that will take it to a whole nother level of constitutional crisis. And so we are trying to continue in the process that we have to get the information, to lay it out in hearings, and we will continue to try to do that because we know what a serious step is, impeachment hearings are, and of course we are aware that you have to be able to, it's a political process. You have to be able to pass those articles in the House and then they get referred to the Senate. And so you got to have people with you, but our constitutional responsibility keeps me up at night, and I cannot believe that we in this country have a person in the White House who so callously disregards the constitutional foundations of our country and is absolutely willing and determined to make his voice the only voice that matters in this democracy.
We were about to go to questions, but I would feel remiss if I didn't ask you a little bit about climate change and the Green New Deal before we go. So we'll try and keep it super short so that we can get to the audience questions. But we're seeing climate change being talked about more in the presidential race. Our governor in Washington State is running for president with that as his main platform. I guess I'm just wondering how, for you, the Green New Deal doesn't necessarily right now have a bunch of implementation in it. Sets an outline, a 2050 deadline for the United States to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions. Do you think that even in a resolution form, this is something that can get the United States on that path? And is it feasible to reach that goal given the roadblocks you might have in the administration currently?
Well, the Green New Deal is a blueprint. It's a vision. It's a really important document for sort of laying out this is the future that we see. It isn't a detail. I mean, it's, I think it's 18 pages or 12 pages or something. Last year, I was the lead co-sponsor of the 100 by 50 Act, which was a detailed plan of how we get to 100% renewable energy by 2050. I think that's too long, to be totally honest. I mean, I think we should have done it yesterday. But the reality is we got to get money out of politics. We have to get the fossil fuel companies out of their contributions to stop some of these things from happening. But yes, I think it's absolutely possible with the right people in power. And it, like immigration, is also a question of political will. I grew up in Indonesia. I spent 12 years in Indonesia as a child, and some of you may have seen the New York Times story that Indonesia is becoming the first country to physically relocate its capital city of Jakarta, which is where I grew up, because of sea level rise. It is sinking. So they are going to relocate it. We are not even acknowledging in the White House that climate change is real and that science matters. And so we can't look at New Orleans and the levees breaking, or Texas and Florida and sea level rise and the impact, much less talk about all of the effects of greenhouse gases and on people's health, on frontline communities. So it's going to take a lot of work, but I think what the Green New Deal has done is it's lifted the urgency of the issue. And today you may have seen the polling that says that climate change is one of the top issues for voters, Democratic voters across the country. And a lot of that is because of the organizing on the ground of these incredible young people, the Sunrise Movement and AOC.
Well, I'm going to start going to audience questions. I appreciate that answer. I think that there's a lot of that discussion will be continuing, clearly. So here we have a question that I think a lot of people probably share. Thanks for upvoting. It's really helpful to know which questions you guys want. So this is one saying, given the high rate of public support for progressive policies, why are Democrats still so tentative about fighting for them at the national level? What do you think of that question, and what's your response?
Well, I think that I don't take any corporate PAC money. One of the first bills we passed was H.R. 1, which John Sarbanes did a fabulous job for the People Act around transparency and accountability and getting money out of politics. I have the House version of Elizabeth Warren's sweeping anti-corruption bill. And I say all this to say I really do think money plays a big role in things and in stopping things from happening. More and more candidates are running without corporate PAC money, which I think is really, really big. Second, I think it's kind of what I said at the beginning. It's like this sense that you should be pragmatic, or you should think smaller, or that you should move in incremental steps. I mean, I've had so many people say to me, that's too big, Pramila, think smaller. Who on earth ever did anything great in this country by thinking small? We have to think big. And we have crises of huge scale, climate change, healthcare, immigration. We need to be bold about what we do. And I want to see more candidates use their platforms to think boldly about what can be done and lead rather than follow. Vote for something before it's popular and help use your platform to make it popular. That's how I think about my office. And that's what I think we need to do. And I think we're electing more and more people like that. And it's fantastic. And people who come and represent the different parts of this country have more at stake in the conversation as well. So I think all of those things are helping us to get there. And certainly we as a progressive movement and many of the people in this room are part of helping to make that happen.
We also, this actually dovetails with a question I wanted to ask, but we ran out of time. Samantha has a question saying, your recent speech about your gender nonconforming child and the Equality Act was so powerful, she writes. How do you work with Republicans on LGBT issues? Is it possible?
I think it is possible. I thought that it was, maybe it was a positive that in the hearing, people weren't really criticizing gay and lesbian. They were criticizing trans and gender nonconforming. And I thought, okay, well, that's sort of interesting. This is the new tip of the spear. But, you know, gay marriage became popular, and they had to drop that as an issue. So now we've moved to trans rights. And, you know, I am, thank you, Samantha, for asking the question. I am just so proud of my 22-year-old who allowed me to share their story. And I'm so inspired by the people across the country who wrote to me and said, it matters so much that you told that story and that you recognized gender nonconforming and trans folks across the country and that you used the they pronoun. I think we just have to keep telling our stories. And I think, yes, it's possible. And I actually think the majority of Republicans know that this is the right thing to do. But perhaps they're being told by their churches, maybe, you know, they just can't quite get themselves there. But they realize that the world is moving on without them, and they better get on board.
And I want to say, actually, Samantha, I apologize. I should not have assumed a pronoun either. I did notice during your speech you were very careful. You used the they pronoun, and that did, I think, send a message that others should be doing that as well and not assuming. So let me find another question here. Thanks
it's
for submitting.
It's been really tough for me. Can I just say something about the gender pronoun? I mean, it's taken me a while just because, not because of resistance, but just I was so used to saying my son, my son, my son. And there are certain words. Now I use my kid or my child, but Janneke's 22. You know, so we've had this conversation. Like, our language has not come up with words yet. And so I just want to say to everybody who's out there, like, I'm so grateful that I have a kid who is so generous with me when I screw it up. But it's taken me a while to be able to just retrain myself. But how beautiful that is. And my 78-year-old mother in India, who is a counselor, just decided to take a queer-affirming counseling course. And so she just finished it, and she is just incredible, right? At 78 years old in India, she's learning about this and she's communicating it to other people there. And so we are on a path, people. We can get there. I know we can. Everybody can be respected for who they are and who they love.
We have a question about housing affordability, which is something we didn't get to talk about. So before we go, question from Orlando is, affording a home is difficult in Seattle and in many big cities across the United States. What policies can help address this on the federal level? And is your staff paid a living wage? It's going to jam that one in there at the end. So yes. So your thoughts on that?
Yes, we always have paid a living wage. We're hoping to increase that as our MRA, which is our amount that we're assigned by Congress, goes up. And finally, you know, interns are going to get paid $15. Well, we finally have a pool for interns in Congress, so we can finally start paying our interns as well. Housing affordability is a huge issue, and we've just hired somebody who's starting on Monday who has a lot of experience as our senior counsel on housing and homelessness. I've already done a lot of work around Section 8 vouchers, you know, tax credits, a bunch of different things, but in the end, it's about how much money the federal government is willing to invest into housing affordability. And we have got to increase the amount that we put into the Housing Trust Fund, and then we've got to deal with the other pieces that end up resulting in homelessness, right? So mental health, rent increases, and some of that is done at the local level. But the federal government has a huge role to play in non-discrimination within housing, in terms of housing investments in general, and then also encouraging things like transit-oriented development and other pieces that link housing to transportation, to education, et cetera. So we have a whole portfolio of things that we'll be working on around housing and homelessness, and some of it can only be done locally, but the federal government has a huge role to play on that.
I think we have time for one more question. And this one is from Rick. And it is, how do progressives avoid weakening the Democrats like the Tea Party weakened the Republicans in 2008 by having candidates too far left to win their district? Your thoughts on that?
We've been really careful. The Progressive Caucus PAC, we've raised now $2 million into the Progressive Caucus PAC. And we are recruiting candidates across the country. And I think there's a couple things. One, we learned in the last election that we finally had to move away from the myth of the likely voter to the truth of every voter. So redefining the electoral base differently is very important to what you think is possible. So a lot of people say, don't run a left candidate who is for Medicare, left candidate in parentheses, in quotes, somebody who supports Medicare for all, for example. Well, we have at least 8, I think, people who ran in swing districts previously controlled by Republicans, who ran on Medicare for All, who won on Medicare for All, and who are on the Medicare for All bill. We just did a poll in 32 swing districts last year with the Progressive Caucus PAC on so-called progressive issues, including a $2 trillion investment in infrastructure, which President Trump just said he agrees with, but the Republicans are now pulling him back. And we found that people across the country want that in swing districts. Same thing with race. People say, don't talk about race. It's the elephant in the room. You can't talk about it. No, we tested a question on infrastructure investment. We tested it with race, the exact same question, with race and without race, and the one with race did better. So we got to talk about this stuff and not assume that we can't win. All of that said, we are very careful about who we support and how we make sure that we win districts. But I do believe that big Democratic primaries are important, and we should not try to quash people who run by saying you can't win. People told me I couldn't win. And you know what? I work a hell of a lot harder, and I knew I was going to win. But we just, we can't, we got to let thousand flowers bloom. And then we've just got to make sure we support the person that ends up out of the primary and give people the ability to run and to win and to really make a difference.
Well, I think we're out of time, and I really appreciate this full crowd and everyone coming to CrossCut Fest and sitting with us while we chatted for this time.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you to Melissa Sanchez. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to CrossCut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the CrossCut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to CrossCut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the CrossCut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And for the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. CrossCut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Baumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.